Hello, fellow homebrewers. JP here, and I want to introduce to you the brand new Brewbuilt X1 Conical Series available at More Beer. More Beer sells the highest standard in homebrewing equipment, and the Brewbuilt Conicals are just that. They're made from mirror-polished 304 stainless steel, and they come with loads of features that you and I have been looking for. They have a full 2-inch bottom dump valve, which will eliminate your clogging issues, while the sturdy base includes 4 reinforced legs, just like those big pro tanks do. More Beer also carries the Brewbuilt line of options and add-ons like casters, pressure kits, and even external glycol chillers. So you can find out more about the new Brewbuilt X1 conical uni tanks by going over to morebeer.com for detailed videos on the entire line of Brewbuilt conicals. You can trust Brewbuilt with your next fermentation, and you can trust More Beer to find the right conical for you. Brewbuilt at morebeer.com.
Welcome to the session. It's good to be back. I'm your host, Justin Crosley. Got a great show for you today. My old friend Rye Bevel is back in the studio today with the Japan Beer Times and other publications as well. He's been on a couple times now talking about...
This is my fourth time, actually.
Is that right?
I think so.
We must like you around here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, and you and I have been talking over email over the last couple years, just before COVID, during COVID, and every time come up with a new show topic list. And we're finally back in here doing shows this year. So I thought, all right, it's time to get Rye back in here and talk about some things. So we're going to be doing that today. We're going to be talking about acquisitions. I'm sure you all know that Sapporo recently purchased Stone Brewing. Big surprise in the beer world. Maybe not to everybody. So we're going to talk about that. And there's been a few since we've last spoke anyway. And just kind of get an update on the beer scene in Japan. I know it was hit like a lot of places, but maybe quite worse in Japan over COVID. And the reaction to that. So we're going to learn all about that today with Rye. So just hang in there with us. I want to thank our sponsor, More Beer. You can go to morebeer.com and check them out. You can also check the show notes of this very show and click on all sorts of links. And it helps us out if you do your More Beer shopping by clicking the links in the show notes. Be sure to check out the Komos line of everything. It's all my favorite new stuff from More Beer. The jockey boxes, the kegerators, you name it. Over at morebeer.com. All right. So before moving on, I wanted to do a little beer news because some of it was topical for this. Of course, the big news over the last several weeks was Stone being purchased, and we're going to talk all about that. But I also just recently learned, I think I was a little behind the times on this one, but it looks like Maui Brewing is going to acquire Modern Times. So apparently Modern Times, due to a bankruptcy status, went up for auction. And Maui had actually lost the bid on that. But there were some confusing things that happened where the winning bidder was actually outbid by like $100,000. But somehow the auction didn't recognize that second bid. So they gave it to the winning bidder, which are the same people that bought back Ballast Point.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, so the judge upheld, you know, after going to court with this second bidder, the judge ended up upholding the winner, which is Kings and Convicts. I think it has another, their ownership group has another name. Well, by the time they got done with the court and the ruling that their winning bid could go ahead and stand, they backed out. And said, well, we don't want it now anyway. And that left it to the backup bidder, which is my friend Garrett at Maui Brewing Company.
Great guy, too.
Yeah, and knows what he's doing. So I think, you know, Modern Times had a lot of management issues and some really dynamic and fast growth that I think they had trouble keeping up with. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they got a lot of bad press during the Me Too movement for some things that had been going on with management. So anyhow, I think that Maui is just the right type of company to take that brand back. What I don't know is if they're going to keep it as Modern Times or switch it all over to Maui. I couldn't get Garrett on for this, so I'll have to do a follow-up. We're going to be doing some more of these like acquisition type shows. We're going to have my friend Jamil on. We haven't had him on the session in a while. I think he's in a good position to talk about acquisitions right now. And yeah, I want to find out if he's going to keep it as Modern Times.
And interestingly, they own, at least they used to, quite a few tap rooms, correct? They had the Modern Times tap room up in Portland.
But they shut a bunch of them.
They shut that one down. Okay, and then there was the one in Temescal.
Yeah, and I don't know how many they have left. Mm-hmm. But what they do have is a nice-sized brewing facility down in San Diego, and I'm certain that that's what Garrett is interested in. Also, if I had to guess, he's a stickler about Maui beer.
Being brewed in Maui, right?
Right. So I'm guessing he might keep the Modern Times moniker, but you never know.
Why not? They had good branding. They had good beer.
I think
it's a brand you with legs still.
I think so, too. It other than the bad press that they got, and by the way, I shouldn't just call it bad press. Other than the bad things that were occurring within the company that needed to be fixed, and in fact, their CEO had to step down. I think they made some real changes as they needed to. Other than that blemish, I don't think they really had any blemishes before that. I just think that there was probably some management issues in that, like, fast of a growth cycle that they went through. So it'll be super interesting to find out what happens. It's not a completely done deal yet that Maui has acquired them, but it looks like it's moving forward. So we'll find out. Stay tuned. The other thing I wanted to cover, and I read about this in the Los Angeles Times about a week ago, and I wanted to cover it because I've been not on the show, but in my personal life, I've been going on rants lately about the broken recycling system. And I guess I've been going on rants about California in general because we have a lot of problems here in this state that have grown out of control. Despite our, I don't know what to even call it, our best efforts to be a progressive state, our best efforts to be leaders in policy, green policy, for example, housing policies. But you know what? We are screwing it up left and right. We're seeing the housing shortage and homelessness issue right here in front of the Hop Grenade. I'm now working with the city on a weekly basis about programs to help right around here. So you've got that sort of thing happening. But the other thing I've been really upset about in recent years is our recycling program. And this one I'm upset about because it's a bold-faced lie.
And it's one of those things that California tries to pride itself on, correct?
Yes.
This green policy, and yet here you have dysfunctional
system
in place for the recycling.
It's very dysfunctional. And in and so we were one of the first to start a real residential recycling program. And it had quite a lot of success in the beginning, but it's only gotten worse instead of better as time has gone on. And what it's resulting in, and what the Los Angeles Times was reporting on, is that small breweries are having trouble getting cans again. There's not enough aluminum to go around. And that's particularly true with beer cans because a lot of recycled aluminum is needed to keep up with demand. And demand has skyrocketed for craft brewers because most of them have switched to cans. Mm. Russian River, once again, might be the smartest brewery on earth, having stuck it out with that bottle that is on the shelf. So one of the biggest problems is because of the failed recycling system in California, which kind of stems around whether you're using a single stream or a multi-stream type of recycling process. California has been touting a successful multi-stream process or single stream process because we put all of our recyclables into one big garbage can, at least up here in the Bay Area, recycling can, and they come pick it up and they tell us, don't worry, we're going to do all the sorting for you. But the truth is, That's not the truth. And contamination occurring is causing a massive amount of the recyclables that we're putting into those single stream cans ending up in the landfill. And it's because we're not being told that we should be separating, that they should be separating, and that our single can stream of recycling is a complete failure. Our efficiency in recycling has gone down something like 35% over the last decade, when it really should have been going the opposite way. We should have been recycling more than we ever were, and instead, we're recycling less. And at the same time, it really bothers me because we pay for that recycling to go away. So years ago, California starts the CRV program, where you're essentially supposed to get back cash for returning your cans. And we had all of these sort of local recycling stations, either at the grocery store itself or often in the grocery store parking lot, they would subcontract. Well, when the price of recycling, the price of metals dropped drastically about a decade ago, all of those smaller recycling centers started closing. So now you can't even find a place to take your recyclables. You have to pay the garbage company to come take them. So you don't, not only are you not getting your CRV back, which you're still being charged, you're spending an additional fee to have them take it away, and they get the CRV back, and then of course the cost of the aluminum. And to me, it's a scam. It's a complete scam for cash. And so I was already upset about that. And then I find out that it's because not only am I paying for it, the materials are actually not even being recycled at all. They're still just going to a landfill. And by law, I have to pay them to take it. And now brewers are finding themselves unable to get cans. One of the largest can manufacturers came out just this year and said, we're not even going to take orders for less than 5 truckloads. Now, 5 truckloads of aluminum cans is actually about a lifetime of beer for some small craft brewers who have switched over to canning.
And when you say truckloads, are you talking like 20 foot, 40 foot?
The biggest truck you can find.
Wow.
Yeah. So it almost gets rid of everybody except for Sierra Nevada, New Belgium, now owned by a larger brewery anyway, so that they can buy together. Like, so all of the purchasing power, this kind of fits right into the acquisition topic that we're going to do, goes to these larger companies, right? Because they can buy these things by the boatload. But smaller ones can't do it. Quoted in the article, our friend from Beechwood, Julian Schrago down there, he ended up solving the problem for now. But he said we had to dip into essentially all of our cash reserves to buy as much aluminum as we possibly could. Because
storage issues as well. You know, where are you going to park it?
Right. Exactly right. So it's a massive issue. And according to the LA Times, it's part of it is the recycling program. About 73% of any single aluminum can comes from recycled scrap. And of course, demand for canned beverages has boomed. But the patchwork of recycling and recovery centers has waned. They're gone. And so I don't know. I'm bringing it up because I think it's a massive problem and I hope people start making noise, myself included. That our recycling system is broken. And the kind of loud and proud California green message, that's a bit of bullshit. And I think it's important that we start talking about that. Like, why is it okay to just lie about these things? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying you have to just stop doing it right now, but let's stop saying it's working because it's really not. About 766 million aluminum cans wound up in landfills. Yeah.
Unacceptable.
It's really, especially when, again, and this is where I just get angry about it, you're paying someone to take that away from your house.
Mm-hmm.
You put it in the separate bin for them. You do all the things. I did find there's a lone recycling center left in California. I'm going to start, left in Concord,
okay,
in Concord. My town here.
That's, I was about to say, yeah, I know of one in Berkeley.
Forgive me. Left in Concord here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to start bringing my aluminum cans to them. And honestly, it's the principle of the thing, because I went looking to see how many cans do I have to bring back? I figure like I'm going to stock them up and get like $100, right? Like I'm not going to take them every week, right? I'm going to smash them and put them in a It's going to take me like 2,000 cans before I can get $100.
Wow.
Like the price is just not all that great. But you know what? On the principle of the thing.
Exactly. And, you know, I bought my first BMX bike when I was a kid by collecting aluminum cans from the baseball fields. And I was going to take my daughter out to, you know, you want to collect some cans, like just teach her, you know?
Yeah. Heck yeah. I mean, they literally have a cash value, every one of them. Now, there's another law that was passed in California that says supermarkets, since they sell them and charge us the state mandated CRV, they're required by law to take them back from us.
Oh, interesting.
But they don't. They literally refuse. And nobody is enforcing that law. And I'm telling you, so it's a scam left and right.
What's the point of a law if you don't enforce it?
100%. So I just don't understand it. And meanwhile, and it's frustrating. You and I were talking before the show to hear, you know, our Governor Newsom, you know, on TV. And by the way, I'm neither for or against him as a politician. I think every politician has their goods and their bads, but it's frustrating to hear him tout Green California, and when he knows full well that this is happening.
And this is something, you know, you want him to succeed at, right?
Yeah.
You don't want this to be dysfunctional.
Right. So. And I think both sides of the aisle could really accept that. There's no reason, even if you don't believe in global warming or whatever, I don't care.
When you can't get your beer, it's a problem, right?
It's a problem.
On both sides.
It's a problem.
This is what...
And who doesn't think that we shouldn't waste resources? Like, no matter what, just don't be wasteful.
And if we don't have cans, what are we're going to drink out of? Deerskin pouches?
Well, we'll go cartons. Back to, yeah, exactly. We'll go back to something and then we'll have a shortage of that. There was a glass shortage not too long ago. So
Germany's having that problem too.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem in Germany. So let's stick to the cans. Let's recycle them and let's get it right.
There we go. There we go. All right. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. You can search the article yourself. There's a lot of info in there, but it's in the LA Times. It's called Brewers Need Cans. And then it talks about how California's broken recycling system is making them hard to find. All right. And the last little thing I have in the news, Great American Beer Festival is coming back this year. It's a little bit smaller than usual, based on they're doing some renovations at the Denver Convention Center, but it is back as an in-person festival this year. I'm doing the awards and all of that stuff for them as usual.
Were you at the World Beer Cup recently as well?
I was. I streamed the awards for them there too.
Mm-hmm.
GABF, real quick, it takes place October 6th, 7th, and 8th, and I think tickets are on sale if you want to go check it out. Yeah, I did the World Beer Cup in Minnesota, right? Which, did you hear? It's now an annual thing.
I did. I was... you know, there for the CBC, not I didn't stay around for the ceremony, but it's like, wow, yearly, that's aggressive.
Yeah. So, you know, and I had this thought when I found out about that before it was announced, and my first thought was that I wonder if international brewers will not be so stoked about that. But what I was told was the requests they were getting to make it annual were actually more from international brewers.
That's interesting.
So that surprised me. I just thought maybe they didn't want the expense and the trip every year. But I think my assumption was wrong.
Maybe they want the trip every year.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
love coming to America and drinking.
It's pretty fun. Mm-hmm. And I think it's in Nashville again next year.
Yeah, Nashville wasn't bad.
Yeah.
You know, when we went earlier, it was fun.
Love that town. So good way to do it. But yeah, I was happy to see. Some Japanese brewers took home some medal.
Japan did very well.
Really?
Several gold medals. I think there was a silver and a bronze. And then there was a surprise win that we can talk about now or later, depending on how you want to roll with this one.
No, let's talk about it now.
So a brewery called Heiwa Shuzo won a gold medal, I believe, in the Irish Red category. Well, Heiwa Shuzo is a very popular sake brewery.
Okay.
And it was a big surprise in Japan. Wait, what? A sake brewery won a gold medal? We didn't even know they were brewing. We knew they were brewing beer.
Okay.
We had spoken with them, but they'd only been brewing for a few years and won the gold medal in the Irish Red Ale category, which is, you know, impressive.
Yeah.
And in some ways, not surprising. This is an excellent sake brewery. They have a very popular product that I enjoy. You can actually get it in the Bay Area, some of their sake products. So, you know, a good sake brewery is going to understand how to brew beer the right way. They're good about sanitation, controls, you know, recipe making, and they did. And the reason why they were brewing beer, to use that as a segue into our larger discussion, is that they received probably a government grant to pivot to beer production. And there are quite a lot of sake breweries that are receiving grants to pivot.
I see.
Just as beer breweries are receiving grants to pivot into, for example, distilling. So there's these grants available now in Japan post-COVID, or rather, at least post these past 2 years of paying,
yeah,
to encourage businesses to pivot into some sort of new business to help them out.
I see.
And I believe that's how Heiwa Shuzo did it. If they didn't and just decided to brew beer, which some sake breweries do, fine. You know, Hitachi no Nest, everyone knows them. They're originally a fifth generation sake brewery. They still brew sake, but their beer is better known.
Okay. So they're not giving up on sake, any of these pivots. So, it's just adding to the...
Yeah, no way they'd give up on sake. They're multi-generational sake brewing family.
Got it.
You know, there's a 15th, 16th generation sake brewery in Japan. They've been around since 1550, called Konishi, and they brew beer as well. I mean, it's, you know, you kind of do both.
I see.
Often.
I mean, the equipment's probably so similar. And like you said, if they're already good at the sanitation side of things, obviously fermenting. So it's not a massive leap to be able to make good beer.
Actually, sake is much more difficult to brew than beer.
Okay.
So if they can brew sake well, you would guess they would brew beer well. Yeah.
Makes sense. All right. Well, why don't we do this? Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to find out what kind of happened to the alcohol industry in Japan during COVID and how that affected things and how it's looking now.
Let me put on my crash dummy gear.
Hang on. We'll be right back with Rye. Welcome back to the show. We are still speaking with Rye, and we're talking about beer in Japan, a little bit of sake in Japan, too, while we're at it. And before the break, like I said, I wanted to find out a little bit more about how Japan, and in particular the alcohol industry, was affected by COVID. I guess we should say COVID restrictions is probably what happened. So what was the general approach by the Japanese government?
Well, as we all know, alcohol causes COVID, so you must shut down all drinking of alcohol to prevent the spread of COVID. And
is that really what happened? They did, like, no alcohol?
There have been several shutdowns, lockdowns, you know, three or four, and some, they've been differing degrees of severity, but some of them have been no alcohol sales, or no alcohol sales after 5 p.m. because that's when, like, gremlins, COVID comes out and starts to get you.
Right.
Drinking alcohol after 5 p.m., here comes COVID.
Now, are you talking about just at bars or, like, even at the store?
So you could go to the grocery store and you could get alcohol. But you could not go to a bar or a restaurant. So restaurants had to stop serving alcohol. And, you know, if you're a family restaurant or, you know, something like that, fine. But if you're a tap room, or, you know, any sort of brew pub, either you stop selling alcohol and serve tea with your hamburgers and fries, or you just shut down.
Wow.
And so a lot of places just closed.
Wow. Closed.
And now...
And was there government aid for them?
To be fair, there was aid. Now, there wasn't enough aid to tide businesses over.
Mm-hmm.
Just not enough if you're... Now, if you're a sole proprietor and you're the only man or woman behind the bar and just running the place by yourself, it actually made more sense to shut down and take the government grant because...
Right.
Yeah, you get more money that way.
I see.
So there was a few people that shut down. Hey, I'm not working. I'm just going to, you know, take these handouts. But if you had, you know, three or four employees or anything like that, and you had to support, the money wasn't enough.
Right.
And yet you couldn't sell alcohol.
Wow.
It was brutal. I'm shocked more places didn't go out of business.
Sure.
The places that did well had canning lines either on order, or they pivoted very quickly. So that was the saving grace. You know, the irony of our talking about canning and its importance for breweries to get their product to consumers, you know, was highlighted by this situation in Japan, where if you weren't canning, you were done.
Wow.
One good thing about Japan is there's very little regulation when it comes to how you sell alcohol and where. In other words, you know, you could take a beer and walk out into the street and onto the subway and drink that beer, and it's nothing wrong with it.
Okay.
You can ship beer directly to the consumer at their house.
All the way around the country.
Yeah, so
okay.
A lot of breweries pivoted very quickly toward EC sites selling their beer. Obviously, there was a lot of social media activity. Hey, folks, we're struggling, so please order beer from our website. Takeaways were okay. But again, most places make a lot of their money from guests coming, drinking beers, and then eating.
Yeah.
But if you can't have beer, why would you come and eat?
Right.
So this became, you know, a big conundrum. You know, what, should we stay open? Should we just shut down? Is it worth it? And people lost a lot of money.
Wow. Yeah. And how many months are we talking did some of these closures go on?
So I can remember four shutdowns or relative shutdowns, meaning you guys can serve alcohol, but at 5 p.m., you can't. Or at 6 p.m., you have to close your store because COVID comes out after 6 p.m. But there were some that lasted weeks
okay.
or months.
Or like, months,
let's
yeah.
just say, you know, 2 months. There was a particularly harsh one. Was it? Gosh, this past spring, I remember we came out of it and thought, oh, my gosh, please say this is the, like,
yeah,
the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. Were you living there this whole time?
I was not.
Okay.
So this is what's, you know, interesting. I've been, you know, I lived in Japan 15 years. I started Japan Beer Times about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And left, came back to the Bay Area about, I don't know, 7 years ago, because in the age of Skype and Zoom, you can be anywhere. I can remotely manage my business. And I was going back and forth every 2 months, and
okay,
that was sufficient. But COVID came. The last I was there was February 2020, just as it was coming. The zombie ship.
Yeah.
If you remember the zombie cruise ship coming in to Japan and Yokohama. I was there, I saw it. I was like, ooh, that's a boat parked off and everyone in there has, you know, that thing called COVID.
Wow.
And then I flew out and I haven't been able to get back to Japan since then.
Really? Just travel restrictions?
Restrictions. Now, there are ways of getting in, but it, you know, quarantine. So the quarantines were pretty strict, actually. You'd have to do, you know, a week, 10 days. And if you happen to have COVID, then, you know, there goes your trip.
Yep.
And, you know, I have a family here. I can't go and quarantine for 5 days, 10 days, and then spend seven days and then come back. It just wasn't realistic. So it's been rough, but at the same time, I clearly hired the right people because they kept the business going.
Beautiful.
In hard times, right? Because
working from home mostly, probably themselves.
Working from home, And you know, we're an advertising driven magazine. We do have subscriptions, and it's great that we had that stability from, or rather, that ballast from the subscriptions. But we're primarily ad driven. And why would a brew pub or anyone advertise with us if they're shut down?
If they're closed.
Beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was hard. It was hard for everyone.
We had issues with that here too. Yeah. Just advertisers pulling back the purse strings. And even a lot of it was just uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You know, they might not have been hit too hard just yet, but the uncertainty of when the other shoe was going to drop.
Exactly.
You know.
And we got great support from certain advertisers. We had, I mean, one, I would, if it's okay, I'd like to shout out the Yoho, makers of Yona Yona, wrote to us and said, hey, don't worry, we've got your back.
Nice.
Wow. You know, actually, can we sign a 2-year ad contract with you? And that was very awesome of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there were a lot of other, you know, places that said, we really like what you're doing. It's not about the money. Just keep it going and help us out when you can. So it was great to feel that sense of craft beer community that.
Yeah.
Used to be really strong in the craft beer community. There's a feeling that it's a, you know, a little thinner these days, right? But it came together at the right time, and we all looked out for each other, supported each other, and there were businesses that went under, but not as much as you would have expected, given that there were these full-on alcohol lockdowns,
right?
So,
well, and then so before COVID, and for years before COVID, Japan had been planning also for the Olympics.
Exactly.
And which is just a massive investment in infrastructure. But I think the reason countries bid on that and acquire it is because it can really be a boon for all sorts of things. Okay. Except all of that planning and hopefulness was before COVID.
Right.
Okay. So then the Olympics come around and, you know, even from the outside perspective here back in the US, well, which is how you were watching the Olympics too, you could really kind of tell, oh man, this is not going well.
Yeah. That first, as we entered the spring, there was a lot of unknowns about COVID and, we were like, the Olympics aren't going to happen. What do we do?
Right.
And we had all prepared, everyone, breweries, Everyone had ramped up. I think, we also import malt to Japan as a sort of side business, and we had imported containers of malt for all these breweries that thought they would need to brew this beer. So everyone had, really ramped up production and invested all this money into the expected crowds that they would have and the demand, and then suddenly
nothing
happening in 2020. The government carried it on as far as they possibly could before canceling.
Yeah.
And I've heard rumors, well, there weren't rumors, I've heard from politicians through back channels that it was a stare down with the insurance companies.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they tried to keep the Olympics alive for the longest time that they could before they finally said, ain't going to happen.
Right.
And, but they postponed it for a year.
Yeah.
So Japan was absolutely determined to host these Olympics. It was their big dream. It was a surprise that they won the Olympics.
Okay.
A little bit of backroom stuff going on.
Yeah.
But let's put that aside. They won the Olympic bid, for better or worse. They were so determined to have it. This wasn't just the economic benefits. It was a matter of national pride.
Yeah.
Japan's big on soft power. Extending their culture throughout the world and being seen as a nation. So they were absolutely determined to host those Olympics in 2021.
Even though it had to be clear that it was not going to be a financial success.
Yeah.
Even in 2021.
By that point, it didn't matter. So how do you host a safe Olympics?
Mm.
I mean, you go totally all in on the restrictions.
Mm.
You make sure you do everything you can to keep COVID contained, to keep the numbers down. So then came the sledgehammer again on the alcohol industry. It's all the bars that are causing the spread of COVID.
Right.
Meanwhile, you could have like concerts and baseball games going on, but the alcohol industry is causing,
Yeah.
It was just like we would call up other brewers and like, why is the hammer coming down? What?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Mm.
And you would think that Kirin and Sapporo and these larger beer companies would also be impacted. Of course, they were impacted by it.
Sure.
Where is their lobbying power? Why weren't they pushing back and saying, hey, why is the alcohol industry being picked on here?
Yeah. Well, it happened here, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were asking the same questions here, and the answers were, okay, well, it's because you get loud and touchy and everything else when you're out at a crowded bar, but you don't do that at wherever. I don't know where they thought. Mm-hmm. But I was having the same questions, like, where is the lobby on this?
Mm-hmm.
Because the airlines are doing all right. They're getting a ton of help. Mm-hmm. So they have a massive lobby like anybody. So, and I just thought the same thing. Yeah, obviously it wasn't going to be the craft beer lobby, mm-hmm. but what about, Seagram's, like the alcohol, like the full liquor lobby.
Right. Cause it wasn't just beer. It was alcohol in Japan.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's important. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And here too, although I think to a lesser degree, but I still had the same questions that you're asking and that, where's the lobby on this? Come on, guys.
It could have been just a political decision. Let's make the boogeyman the alcohol industry.
Something
alone
to
buy it. And then as politicians, we'll look like we're actually trying to do something.
I think that's a fair assessment all over the world, or at least in this country too. I think that's pretty fair.
But what's interesting, there were speakeasies in Japan.
Oh, yeah, nice.
People were opening up. You knew where to go if you wanted to have your beer. And people did. And you can say, well, that's risky. That's irresponsible. Well, actually, Japan's got a pretty good record with COVID. Their cases have been low and people aren't dying en masse like they are in America.
Right.
It's what, 1 million people have died. And, in Japan, it's, not
to no, nowhere near. Point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly healthy country.
Right.
Longest life expectancy in the world. Maybe Monaco is higher. But, people made their own decisions and snuck out to the speakeasy and had a few beers. And so,
I mean, at some point these things are going to happen, mm-hmm. right? Early on, it's me and some of my friends, we'd see that happening, not at a speakeasy, but mm-hmm. like house parties mm-hmm. and stuff. And I was upset by it because mm-hmm. My business was still being shut down. And so there was a part of me who thought, that's irresponsible and you're not being a part of the solution. But I was frustrated by so many things, by mm-hmm. us being targeted and picked on as an industry.
Right.
So as time went on, I started to understand it more. That it was just like, these are young people that aren't dying mm-hmm. and the restrictions have gotten to be so tiring mm-hmm. and cumbersome that this is just human nature. I stopped being upset with mm-hmm. these people and just understanding a little more about human nature.
And shockingly in Japan, I mean, this is a place with quite a high level of social conformity, rule following. People started, from the speakeasies, it just moved into businesses flaunting the restrictions, saying, we don't care, this is silly, we're just going to open up. It's dumb. If like why can there be sporting events indoors where everyone can gather, but we can't serve alcohol? That's silly. So, you know, everyone, we're open.
And there wasn't a lot of authorities.
You would have expected there to be social backlash, because in Japan, you know, if you're the nail that sticks out, you get hammered down.
Okay.
But there were so many businesses doing it, and the government eventually kind of realized,
this is going
to
happen.
How are we going to enforce this? We're going to ask people to conform. And there were businesses that, you know, acted responsibly in the context of the government's directives, but there were other businesses that said, let people make their own choices. Our bars are open. If you want to come and drink, drink.
There you go.
And defied the regulations. Now, that didn't happen in the beginning, but I would say after a year, people are like, enough's enough.
Yeah.
What do we have to lose? Our business is going to go under if we don't. So let's just open up and let the dice roll.
And interestingly, you know, that was starting to happen here too, but our government cracked down even more. Even our local government here, our county supervisors, oh boy, I could go on
this
about
is Contra Costa, correct?
Contra Costa. And we've got one, her office is right behind me, right here. And very stern letters were being written from this office about there, because they were sending out county health officials to fine businesses that were doing just what you were saying. Right. And we didn't have to defy the rules here yet per se, but had things kept going, there were discussions about that. You know, okay, how much is the fine going to be? And I just was kind of flabbergasted that they would have the balls to even go do that at a time. In other words, and these are conversations everybody's had, so forgive me that it's maybe a little redundant at this point, but you know, if the decision is to go out of business and that affects your family, or defy the rules so that you can make a little cash and maybe get some fines, you're putting me in a very difficult position, aren't you? So in other words, I actually think the authorities here were harder on businesses than it sounds like they were in Japan.
That's really interesting.
You know.
And you know, another thing with Japan, as you've seen, everyone commutes, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
These trains, and you've seen how packed the trains are. So wait a minute. People commute in the trains to the office, but we can't go to a bar and
like
drink?
Come on. Everybody knows. And by that time too, by 21, right? We know full well how everybody's getting it, right? And it's in a small, confined, not very ventilated space like a train.
Yes.
So that's just the silliest. Yeah. But I think that you're right that there had to be an appearance of we're doing something when truthfully, no one knew what the fuck to do. I can't wait for the documentaries that are going to come out in a decade.
I would like to see the real data.
Yep.
You know,
yep. I want to know all the things.
And I would keep an open mind. It's like, okay, did the masks work? Did they not? And, you know, Japan is high level of masking. So it wasn't like everyone was being necessarily irresponsible. People were still practicing hygiene. But let's look at the data. Let's figure out why Japan has done so well during the pandemic. And they have, and they continue. It's been a mystery. And some of it, yeah, I agree. You know, it's hard to get tested in Japan. So there is a level of suppression of data.
Okay.
But at the same time, people aren't dying.
Yeah.
And Japan's a very healthy country.
Yeah.
But people are still commuting in trains and packing in there. I mean, there's all these variables. And I just kind of want to know.
I know.
Right?
I can't wait.
But one thing I do know is that the COVID gremlins don't just come out after 6 p.m. when you're drinking alcohol. I mean, this is something that everyone understood.
Like, you don't need any data to show you that.
I don't. Yeah. It's like you can catch COVID during lunch and you can catch it drinking a pint in your local. And you already mentioned that, well, when you get drunk, you have bad behavior and you start pulling down your mask and getting close to people. But, you know.
Yeah. But at that point, I mean, I think it's irrelevant, to be honest. But I don't know either. I'm not going to stand too high on my soapbox without seeing the data, too. I just don't think we're going to see it for a very long time. And the other thing I want to know about the real conversations that were being had, too. before certain restrictions were decided upon.
I want to be in the room when where it happens.
Yeah, totally. From, and we'll find out one day. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll either be a fictional tell-all movie or a documentary. Mm-hmm. We will find these things out, and I hope I'm still alive mm-hmm. because I think it's going to be fascinating and probably pretty frustrating to watch, to find out too. I mean, like, so we keep saying the alcohol industry, mm-hmm. but in both with my own location and brew pubs, like you mentioned in Japan, let's just talk about the restaurant industry really as a whole, because the restaurant industry, which I include as bars in, mm-hmm. That's what was really targeted. So you didn't even have to just be a manufacturer of alcohol, right? And the numbers even that we do have about failed restaurants in my state across the country, they're already staggering. They're fucking staggering. Wow. How many have closed. And those closures aren't done yet.
And these are small businesses that I'd like to add. They're small businesses that traditionally hire a lot of people. It's not like a big industrialized business that's running on machinery. So small businesses, restaurants are very important to our economy.
Yeah.
To a sense of people's well-being, you know, to be involved in something and to have that camaraderie at work. So it's you know, been devastating.
And so has it bounced back in Japan?
So that's the good news. I would definitely say it's bounced back. We talk to not just our advertisers, but, you know, people in general. How are things going? A few places say, hey, we're back to pre-pandemic levels, even though Japan still doesn't have inbound tourism. You still can't.
Okay.
Can't go to Japan. I mean, they've sort of have tried these trial tours, but there's still no inbound tourism in Japan, and that's huge. It's a big part of the economy. Hmm. Nevertheless, some businesses have still bounced back. Others haven't. They're operating at anywhere between 60% and 80% is what a lot of folks tell us. But interestingly, there's lots of brew pub openings going on that have happened throughout the pandemic, because Japan is an old country, an old civilization. They just have a longer timeline than Americans. Our country's been around 200 years. And like Konishi Brewery been around since 1550. They just have a different way of looking at things. They've been through so much. They're looking way ahead.
Yeah.
And it really influences the culture as a whole, their perspective. You know, this is just one of the bumps in the road, and they're looking forward. So a lot of people kept moving forward with their business plans. Hmm. Whereas here in America, you pull the plug quickly, right?
Yeah.
Big bummer for me was, you know, Michelin Bar going down in San Francisco. They pulled the plug on that.
Mm-hmm.
But in Japan, they kept moving forward on these brew pub openings. And so there's been, dozens and dozens of new openings during the pandemic, despite these terrible conditions.
Wow.
So, wow. Yeah. Perseverance. I mean,
sure.
It's big in Japan, the perseverance, the whole word.
Yeah.
And so now Japanese breweries, including brew pubs, we're approaching 500.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the recent numbers. And pre-pandemic, it was probably, you know, a little over maybe 350. Again, I'm just tossing out rough numbers. But to give you an idea, you know, there's been about 100 openings during the pandemic.
That's impressive.
In America, where you have, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 breweries, it's small. But in Japan, where, you know, you're talking, 20% increase of brew pub openings. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
So there that's the good news.
Yeah. I wonder too, perseverance, but also there must be some funding behind that. I mean,
There was probably funding that had been secured
pre-pandemic.
Yeah. And then funding in spite of it all, whether you call it denial or just a long view.
Right.
And then, of course, there have been government grants to pivot. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a sake brewery or a distillery or whatever. You could be a pizza shop, and you could get this grant to pivot and open up a brew pub.
I see.
And brew pubs in Japan can be really small.
What size grants are we talking? It must vary.
You apply for it.
Yeah.
And then you submit the business plan. We're doing it right now.
I see.
For a project. And you have to justify, you know, what you're asking for.
Sure.
And so it could be enough to purchase some equipment. I haven't spoken to somebody who's gotten a grant large enough to, you know, open up the whole brew pub, but I do know some brew pubs, for example, like, oh, here's our chance to go into distilling, and they've gotten a grant and that covered. So I should ask, as a publisher of the magazine, gosh, how much does it cover?
Yeah. Just out of curiosity,
but
you know.
For us, it's certainly enough to cover the project that we want to do.
Mm-hmm. I see. I think that's money well spent. I think it's it's the right kind of investment back in.
Because they're giving you money to launch a business, trusting that you have the expertise, because they look at your business. You do have to submit your taxes and your business plan and all these and say, okay, well, they've been successful until this point.
Mm.
So let's give them some more money and see if they can generate some more
business.
And then, of course, Japan gets to tax that
yep.
if they're successful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely a great use of taxpayer money.
Yeah.
So
I mean, if you're going to give away money.
Yeah. The bureaucracy in Japan isn't all evil. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they shut down the alcohol. Maybe they felt bad. Or, I don't know.
yeah.
But.
Well, because, look, I know, as you know, from our many discussions on the show, I know enough about Japanese culture to carry on a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. But part of what I know is that alcohol is important.
Oh my God.
In the culture. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that even that statement, even though I know you're speculating, they really might have felt bad. It's like it's a part of the culture, mm-hmm. you know? So, maybe we got to do right by these folks. Yeah.
This isn't like Gavin Newsom at the French Laundry.
Yeah. I mean,
this is like
right.
all the politicians drink. And, you know, it's
right.
like maybe we ought to do a good one by our friend. I'm sure they all have friends that are in the alcohol industry somehow.
Yeah.
At least you would hope. But I think they wanted to write the wrongs, or at least the suffering of the pandemic. You know, people did their part. They did their shutdowns, and it's like, all right, how do we fix it? And the grants were a very clever way to do it. And it's not like those, what are the PPP loans that went to companies that didn't need them in America. That irritated me so much because companies that just didn't need that money got it and misappropriated those funds. And I really needed it.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. We needed it. I'm only here because of those programs still, you know, because of our closures. So, seeing it being wasted in other ways, you know, like the PPP, and you could say what you want about it, and people certainly do, was designed to stay open and retain employees. Mm. Well, that's exactly what I did. I have almost my entire staff from pre-pandemic and added new ones
good.
And we're here because of, and I'm proud of that. And I'm thankful that the program was created to allow me to do that.
So my taxpayer money went to a good use.
I'll have another beer. A portion of it did.
Okay.
But I guess what I'm saying, but there was also a lot of waste. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of a program that goes, okay, we do have money for you. But it's for you to create with. It's for you to do what you've already proven you can do.
And here's where it gets interesting. You have to have proof of concept. Mm. So you actually have to do it. You got to launch it. They're saying you think
that money's coming.
So you do have to have the money to go forward. But the money's there. They say, okay, if you actually do what you say you're going to do, then we'll go. So
I see.
You do have to come up with some funds. But generally, you should be able to do that somehow, especially if you've got the government saying, hey, We're waiting here with the honey bucket. So just make sure you do it, and then here you go.
I think it's a smart investment.
So, you know, investors, it's great for investors too, because they say, oh, well, you got the government behind you with the honey bucket. Well, here's our money to get it going.
Yeah.
Government dumps in, you know, the honey. The business is moving.
Sure.
Investors get their money back. You've created jobs. Very sensible program.
It's not how Sapporo bought Stone, is it?
Not Sapporo is a very
amazing.
But I don't know what's going on. You know, what kind of things are going on between these, you know, these large companies and the government? There's a lot of stuff going on.
Sure,
that's not in my pay grade.
There's some back scratching.
Yeah. But Sapporo is a very old, traditional company. Very old. You know, this is going back. You know, I should have looked up the history of Sapporo. I'm going to guess they go back to late 1800s.
Okay, yeah.
You know, Kirin's origins go back that far. But Kirin's gone through various iterations before it became Kirin, and it continues to evolve. Whereas Sapporo is a very traditional, conservative company. They've stayed pretty consistent in their approach to the market.
But I'd say they're making some, they're making some moves.
Yes. And so.
And some of them are risky.
They are.
I think Stone's a risky move.
Yeah. And indeed. And you know, before that, they bought Anchor, and everyone's kind of like, that's an interesting one. So Sapporo is interesting. Somebody described it to me as almost a real estate investment company. They have a lot of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
and they buy, they have, they own their real estate holdings in Japan are huge. So they may own this brewery, but they own the land, they own these.
Right. So, yeah.
When they bought Anchor, there was a lot of speculation. Wow, they bought that property right there in San Francisco. It's close to the Warriors' new stadium.
I mean, close enough. Yeah.
I mean, that's an investment. That's a nice real estate investment on its own.
Yeah.
And the price that they paid for Anchor was not a lot. But I went out with the team, the management team. You know, when after they acquired it, they sent in some folks. And, you know, I went out with them. They're genuine people. They wanted to really get a feel of San Francisco and understand more. And I think they were genuine when they said, you know, we invest in brands that have long-term potential.
Hmm.
And you can say, well, yeah, Anchor's kind of gone off. But they saw it differently. I think they genuinely believe, like, look, this is, you know.
They might not be the rock star, and they're never going to be again,
but they
have a story. Probably not going anywhere.
But they have a story, they have a legacy, and Sapporo, as this old company, said, well, that means something. And so I took them by Toronado, and at the time, I don't know, Toronado still had Anchor Steam up, you know, and they're selling it for something like $4 a pint. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And the Sapporo people were so blown away. They're like, wait, that doesn't make sense. How are they making money?
Yeah.
And so, and Toronado said, well, the working man's got to drink too.
Yeah.
And it was so awesome. It was such an awesome moment. And Sapporo just really changed their thinking. Like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And because they did. They bought, you know, this brand that they wanted to have long-term potential. And it's important to have a nice craft beer that's, you know,
yeah,
drinkable and affordable. And I hope that's where they take it. I hope they try to continue that legacy forward.
And well, how long have they owned it now? It's been a couple years, I thought.
A few years, yeah.
It's a few, okay. Because an alcohol company, but a liquor company bought it first, and then Sapporo bought it from them.
Yes, that's true.
So that first acquisition had to be almost 10 years ago. So,
I don't think it was that long. Okay. Maybe close, five or six years. I interviewed the CEO for our magazine, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Because... Anchor's exported to Japan. Mm-hmm. It was just an interesting story, and that CEO, his name is, I believe it was Matt. I can't remember his last name right now. And he sort of organized that deal with Sapporo.
Yeah,
Sapporo bought it. What's interesting that I just want to touch on this briefly before we move to this other acquisition. They also had the labor movement, the unionization efforts.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh gosh, Sapporo. Anchor's unionizing. This was like a big deal. People forget about it.
Yeah.
And what did Sapporo do? They handled that situation very well in a very, in good faith. They allowed it. And as far as I know, things have been good. Obviously, with any sort of unionization effort, there's going to be some contention. I mean, when you look at what's going on with Starbucks right now.
Yeah.
But Sapporo handled it with... very professionally, as far as I know, and Anchor's moving forward. Now the question is, what are they going to do with that brand?
Yeah.
And so I actually called up, you know, my colleagues in Sapporo in that craft division, and we had a nice conversation, and it's like, what are you guys going to do with that? But, you know, like, you guys have this brand that's amazing. And it's not like I'm trying to make myself out to be this guru, or they're going to listen to me, but I did say, look, you guys have this amazing brand.
Yeah.
With a great legacy, and I hope you do something great with it, and it's never going to be what it was, but it's something I hope you understand the legacy. And they did.
Yeah.
They got it. So they're going to be good stewards of that brand, I hope.
So did they answer you? Did they tell you what, or they just said, we understand?
They said, we're thank you for telling us. We needed to hear that. And any other sort of information or opinions you have, please share with us.
Yeah.
And write us anytime or send us things and let us know. I mean, we're interested in hearing this as we decide what we're going to do with Anchor.
Yeah.
And then I knew they were kind of, because they had established this company inside to not only manage Anchor, but a sort of craft label inside their department. So it was clear they were looking at expansion. And they hinted without hinting, this isn't the end. There's going to be something more.
Yeah.
And of course, with Keyring, we knew after the acquisition of, or rather, they made an investment in Brooklyn Brewery. We had Robin on the show, I think.
Yeah.
Ottaway last time I was on. And then they bought New Belgium. That wasn't a surprise at all. So,
okay. Yeah.
Keyring's looking like sort of new Sapporo was looking. But then Stone. That.
Yeah.
It didn't surprise you, but it surprised me, maybe because it...
Well, let's take a break before I get in stone. And I'm not going to say it didn't surprise me. I'll give you a little more insight into it. Yeah, not the way it surprised others is all. We'll take a quick break. We're talking with Rye about the Japanese beer scene and acquisitions right here on The Session. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. We are still speaking with Rye from Japan Beer Times, and we're talking acquisitions. We were just about to talk about the, I guess, the most recent surprising one,
Stone,
which is where Greg Cook from Stone finally caved, and
imagine that
it was purchased by Sapporo.
Yeah.
Now, and you know, I should have reached out to Greg because. To see if he'd be on the show. I just kind of didn't think he would. I know him, and I thought maybe he'd do it for me, but I didn't know I'd get any real answers anyway, so I didn't bother. I might one of these days, see if he wants to come on. But, you know, my only issue, by the way, with that buyout, in terms, you know, as a craft beer fan, I've never been that craft beer fan that calls people sellouts and is mad about it. I think it's the American dream.
You know, business is a business, right?
Yeah. The mistake I think he made was to say never. Mm. Don't ever say never.
You know, Lagunitas went through that same thing as well.
Just why?
We're never going to bottle. We're never going to sell out. But
I don't understand why anybody bothers saying never anymore.
It's just messaging, you know.
I guess so, but it would make me feel like a douchebag. I don't say never.
But you feel that conviction, and then life changes, and you don't feel that conviction anymore. So I think that's how it happens. People change.
I guess you're right. Right? I guess you're right. But here's why I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. It's a struggling brand in terms of its debt ratio. They made some big moves. I think that they, at a time that they thought would pay off. And then the industry changed right around that same time. It's a tough industry right now. You know, if you read between the lines, or if you get some of these honest articles that come out and don't just keep patting ourselves on the back in the craft beer industry, if you read between the lines, there's some trouble brewing out there. And when you acquire so much debt, even though you're the size of a Stone and you have I still think they have a strong brand, certainly locally in San Diego, it's a scary thing. And they just took on a bunch more debt not that long ago. And then I think, like I said, the industry kind of changed. So the writing is on the wall. Now, was Greg ever going to be broke and homeless if Stone failed? No. I'm sure he saved up enough of everything over time to be okay. But did he want to see the brand just go under, even though he can just go back to Hawaii and live out his life with enough money, right? Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's why I'm not surprised. I don't think that Greg's a hypocrite, by the way, even though I say he should never have said never. I don't think he's a hypocrite. I think what you said, things change. And if he wanted the brand to survive, he didn't have a whole lot of other choices. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of debt there, mm-hmm. right? So also, did you see the purchase price?
It was a good deal.
It's a fucking discount.
Yeah.
I don't think he's walking away any more of a multimillionaire than he already was. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he's getting pennies or anything, but when the balance sheet becomes public, mm-hmm. I think everyone's going to know that that was a bargain. This is not inside information from me. I don't talk to Greg.
Just to add, you know, he did what he loved in life. And felt passionately about. So I think whatever the price is, we can't. Oh gosh, like man, what a failure! He did what he loved in his life, and that we should recognize that
totally. And he built a great.
He carried
thing.
The flaming torch for craft brewing for a long time. But
things, for better or worse,
things change, and this is what happened.
I
admit I wasn't necessarily surprised by Stone being sold because I knew of. Difficulties, certainly from former Stone employees who had become, you know, you're wearing a White Labs hat. And I met some who were working at White Labs and saying, yeah, you got laid off. Now we're here. Like, ooh, you know, employee cuts. And then you saw the market share and it's like, some troubles are brewing. And for those size breweries, there was always a challenge because everyone saw what Ballast did, the $1 billion sale. And so they wanted that sort of trajectory, I think. And a lot of them took on debt trying to become big and then just craft breweries exploded in America, thousands of them. So they started shrinking. And I had this conversation with Bart Watson, the chief economist at the brewing, the Brewers Association. I was like, oh, like, you know, when there was the CBC in DC, what, 3-4 years ago, I was like, these sort of mid-tier breweries, man, aren't they in trouble? Because they took on all this debt. They tried to expand thinking that the future was Ballast Point, and yet suddenly you've got 1,000, 2,000 new breweries taking up market share in your backyard. How are you going to survive?
Yeah.
Coronado did okay. They survived. I was worried about them. But Stone, you know, obviously they felt the pinch. And
they probably, you know, Greg knows this. Greg's a smart guy. He probably should have sold 5 years ago, 8 years ago.
He probably, when they were knocking down his door and offering him probably close to a bill like everyone else was getting, that's probably the time he should have done it. Now, would that have been the right thing for the brand? If you look at Ballast Point, I think it's easy to say no. He would have cashed out and done very, very well for the rest of his life, which I hope that, and he's probably going to be okay anyway. But the Ballast Point brand just tanked.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it? Kings and Convict bought that thing for a penny too. you know.
That's too bad. It was such a, I mean, I like Ballast. I still like Ballast. I mean, I hope Colby is still there brewing. Colby Chan, he was the specialist brewer, and
I think Colby's still involved.
I hope so. Great guy making great beers there. So I don't, I still have some love for the
brand. They're all great people. And well, I have love for the people who built
it.
There
you go.
And also, and I said this earlier, this is why I'm not the mad guy about the acquisitions. I consider it the American dream. And by the way, so does everybody else. They just forget about it when it's their favorite band, right? Like, but you all believe in the American dream, which is, you know, start a company out of your garage and later sell it for $1 billion. Okay. Ballast Point. They're the epitome of that. Even more so, I think, than Lagunitas. I mean, Lagunitas just like stonered his way through it, right? Now, did he make sacrifices and work hard? I'm sure he did. But, you know, Jack White from Ballast, you know, opens a homebrew shop in a tiny, it's still there, a tiny little homebrew shop. And next to it, in the available space to lease next to it, he opens Ballast Point. And toils on those two projects for years, for a very long time. And then with a little help toward the end and all the way through, you know, builds it into
$1 billion.
And you know what? God bless him.
Yeah. And then, you know, well, what happened to the employees? I mean, the VP, Earl Kite, and then Youssef, they're now crushing it with Cutwater Spirits. So the people made out okay.
That's
they got
right.
To father, they got to pursue further dreams.
Yes. You know? And I think Jack White was part of that. Those were part of the deal. I wish we had, Jamil was going to be in here with us today too, and he's probably not allowed to talk about everything with his brewery's acquisition, but I do think he would talk about how there were guarantees about that his staff would be okay and that they could still be working there, because that's the type of person he is. And I think that's the type of person Jack White was, even though he's now a billionaire. I don't think that's a message on his character, right? Anyhow,
one quick story.
Yeah.
Jack White came to Japan. We went out one night, and you know, I took him and his wife and Colby, and we were drinking, you know, shochu and sake till like 3 or 4 in the morning in these backstreet bars in Japan. It was a great memory. That was the last I saw Jack. But he had, you know, ambitions shooting for the moon. I've kept, you know, more or less in touch with Colby every now and then. We'll send emails, and it's been a few years actually. But you know, good people, and I think that's what's important. These sellouts. You know, no, these are good people.
Yep. Who worked hard. You know, it's not. You know, why isn't anybody complaining about like the kid that didn't really work that hard in another industry and sold a brand for $1 billion? Like, no one complains about that. But you know, brewers, Colby. Jack White broke his back for 10 years before that company was worth a shit, right? So I just think, you're barking up the wrong tree. Now, Greg made himself an easy target. So I'm not really going to shush people for making fun of Greg now. Right. He made himself an easy target. But I still am.
The surprise, I mean, sorry. It's just like, wait, Sapporo bought Stone? There was just such disjunction when I saw that news. And again, I said I was surprised because I usually... I've got intel, man. There's a little ego thing. Like, wait, how did I not when I see stuff happen, I'm like, I saw that coming.
Yeah.
And I don't put it out there, but that one just really caught me off guard. So good.
Yeah.
Good for Sapporo for their OPSEC there, their operational security, because I didn't pick on.
Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. Don't you think that they... I see them picking up on cool brands. Mm-hmm. Okay, but with Stone, they also got a massive production facility. And don't you think that... In fact, for the price that they paid, I don't think they paid for the brand. I think they paid for the facilities and the infrastructure.
Like I said, Sapporo is... They think more broadly. They look at an investment in property, infrastructure, real estate, things like that. So, and they're savvy. They saw something that maybe you and I and the rest of the beer industry doesn't quite see. And we think, oh, you know, why did they buy that? They saw something.
Yeah.
They make clever buys. So they're going to do something good with Stone. I have that faith.
Yeah.
What they're going to do, I don't know. They seem long-term. They see long-term potential. Maybe they'll use the facilities. I hope I can say this.
Are they going to brew Stone in Japan?
So Stone is still imported. Stone was one of the first imports in Japan. Wasn't quite the first, but it was the big brand. Mm-hmm. The Stone's importer actually got his big break with North Coast.
Okay.
But then after that, Stone, he tells me the story, Andrew Balmuth of Nagano Trading. He imports Lagunitas, Sierra Nevada, you know, a combination of craft and you know, craft acquired brands.
Mm-hmm.
But I never forget the story because he was really excited about how he pulled over his car. He's like, yes, it's Greg. And Greg's like, listen, man, you got the deal. You can import us. But just do it right. And he did it right. And he built Stone out the brand in Japan. And Stone was the big driver of craft beer imports in Japan.
Okay.
And so when I heard Stone got acquired, that was my first thought. Oh gosh, this, you know, Andrew who had built that brand up in Japan. And that was really the leading edge of craft beer imports in Japan. It wasn't the first, you know, Brooklyn Brewery was actually the first. They'd been there for a long time. Rogue had been there for a long time, but really Stone pushed out into the market.
Mm.
Sapporo, so yeah, you can still import them. You still,
oh,
so
even now you're saying cool. That's
yeah.
Recent.
So
okay.
I might be getting in trouble by sharing this, but yeah, I think.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Like Sapporo, they're like, you know, let's keep things as they are, but let's sort of figure it out from here.
Okay.
Will they eventually brew Stone in Japan and start distributing it? I don't know. It's kind of cooler if you, whether it's environmentally friendly to brew in California and then, you know, export
right.
Japan. I don't know, but.
I don't know either. That one, I would be confused if 5 years from now, they're not brewing some of Stone there. Right. You know, Stone IPA, they're going to brew, they're going to be one or two of the brands,
you know,
there.
Brooklyn Brewery was brewed in Japan, and I wasn't offended by it. Even Robert, Robin and Garrett Oliver would come over and taste it and say, hey guys, you need to make these tweaks. And
yeah,
and I assume Kirin's brewing it over there. I'm not offended by it. It tastes like Brooklyn Brewery.
Yeah.
So will they? Probably, maybe not. Who knows? What that's the mystery. I mean,
yeah.
What will Sapporo do with that brand? I the most I can say is I think they'll take good care of it. They've been good stewards of brands.
So who do you think is next, or what are a couple options for Sapporo that might not surprise you?
Well, Sapporo or Kirin or whatever. I mean, when Modern Times came up, I was like, oh.
Because
they're in Japan. But honestly, and this is, I'm not trying to be pejorative or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Modern Times is a small brand.
Yeah.
Stone's big. So, you know, I'm speaking honestly here. Youngling in Pennsylvania was one that I was always curious about because there was an interesting tradition in that company that the children always had to buy from the parent, you know, the story. And so I guess the four daughters had to buy from the father and that was the deal. And I always wondered, that's going to be a tough one.
As time goes on, yeah.
But it's such an American brewery, you know, it's like my granddaddy's.
I mean, they're the oldest brand. I think. Yeah. I think they're actually our oldest American
brewery. I don't think that would sell, but if you think about something like that, I don't think Youngling's a target. I'm just using that as an example. That was one where I thought, ooh, what's going to happen?
Yeah. There's not a ton left that are the size of Stone.
And I haven't been on top of things, I'm going to speak freely because I'm on my third pint and I'm thinking about brands that are awesome to buy.
Yeah.
Is Cigar City owned by anybody?
Yeah. But they could be sold again. They're owned by that like investment group.
So not even another brewery. And it's been so long now since I reported on that. It's like a small investment group that was buying up just a couple little breweries. Okay. Similar to who bought Heretic.
Okay.
Not the same company, mm-hmm. but just a small like funding group.
Okay.
You know.
New Belgium, I knew was going to go. I didn't have any insight. It didn't surprise me at all when Kieran came in.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've seen people around here looking at hop grenades saying,
it's yours.
We're going to come in and drop,
so cheap.
We're going to drop a billion on you, man.
That's so cheap. Yeah. You know, the only company, I'd say there's only two breweries I would be surprised.
I got one.
Sorry. Okay. Go ahead.
Because I just got back from Minneapolis and I was blown away by Surly.
Surly. Yeah.
I was just like, wow, awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, though, like that.
I think they're going to get bought.
They're awesome. I mean, the beer's awesome. The branding's awesome. The facilities are awesome. They own the Midwest.
Yeah, but I don't think that their numbers are as awesome as their appearance. Hmm. And I don't have that as firsthand information, so forgive me, Surly, if I'm getting that wrong. But again, a lot of investment that they put into that brand, and it's such a cool place and cool beer. I could see them getting acquired for sure. Yeah, I was going to say, there's like two breweries I'd be surprised about it selling.
Okay.
And Maui's not one of them. Now, Garrett's another guy who's a staunch advocate for independent beer. Heck, he's the head of the board of directors on the Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if he sold eventually.
Really?
I'd only be surprised if Sierra Nevada sold, believe it or not.
I don't think they'd sell.
And Russian River.
I don't think they'd sell.
I don't think
so. That's
just
my opinion.
Mine too. Those are the only two.
And if they do, they do. And
yeah, you know. I won't hate it. I would just be surprised. I would actually go, all right, nope, I wouldn't have bet on that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't, even if you'd given me good odds. Mm-hmm. Those are the two. I think that Sierra, first of all, has a succession program, right? Like, that's already in the works. The kids are running the show. Mm-hmm. I think they have to check in with their dad quite a bit. Yeah, they're running the show. So I think that because there's a succession plan, that's not happening in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned Russian River. I don't really know Vinny or Natalie at all. I've met them a few times. Of course, they don't remember me because they meet everyone.
Meet everybody, yeah.
But they've built a great brand. They live the American dream. It's awesome. And what if...
And they love what they do.
Yeah, but there comes a time in your life when you want to do other things. And what if Sapporo came along... And very respectfully, just I'm using Sapporo and say, we're going to be great stewards of your brand.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be. What if it's Duvel?
Yeah.
Great. Awesome.
Yeah.
So they continue that brand. If Duvel or if it's Sapporo, they come in and they continue that brand for everyone's enjoyment. And they hold on to the staff and they somehow maintain the culture that's been established there, which is, I think, the most important part of a business. Why Apple is still successful after Steve Jobs.
Sure.
Because the culture has been maintained. Fine. Let that acquisition happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that happening. You're right. And I know that if they have a succession plan, that it's not public. They don't have kids. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not that happening. I guess I just know that Vinny still loves brewing beer every day. Like, he's just in the brewery every day. And so I just find that hard to, but you're right. One day, you don't want to do that or you can't anymore or something. Mm-hmm. And I guess you don't just let the brand vanish at that point.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's funny that you mentioned Duvel because, they're friends, with the Firestone folks.
Sure.
So you know what? You just maybe changed my mind. If I wouldn't be surprised if
Firestone went.
Well, Firestone's gone. They're to Duvel.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
but
right.
If Russian River went to Duvel.
Oh,
if it was announced, hey, Duvel has also now acquired Russian River. If it happened in the next 10 years, I'd be surprised. After that, yeah, I could see that.
But you know. The thing is, I don't think Kirin or Sapporo's done.
Yeah.
But I think they're just open.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're actively looking. I knew there was a time when Kirin was actively looking. They made it very clear. They told me.
Mm.
They asked me, like, what are some breweries that you would be, like, that you think would be good?
Yeah.
And New Belgium was just it was so obvious. So it was going to happen. And actually, we were tipped off because there was a Kim Jordan sighting in Japan. And we're like,
it's
New
happening.
Belgium's gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously we didn't share that on social media because that's their business, whatever.
Yeah.
Like we report on the news.
Right.
I think it was, I can't remember, my staff saw her or somebody from New Belgium. I remember getting the report and saying, guys, don't put that on social
media. We're not a tabloid here. It's
But I don't think Kirin's done. They can't be. They can't as a company because beer consumption's declining in Japan domestic because of demographic declines. So as a publicly traded company, they have to keep growing their business. So they're going to have to make acquisitions, whether they do it in Australia, where they have a good record, or they do it in Europe. I don't know.
Yeah, don't they own Little Creatures?
Little
Is that
Creatures,
what they own there? Yeah, okay.
And they've been good, like Sapporo, they've been good stewards of that brand.
Yeah.
You know, Japan, those companies have been good. Mm. Good management. And then what happens when Asahi or Suntory decides that they want to get into that as well? Because their shareholders are saying, hey guys,
right.
Like, why are you guys getting in? So, because the domestic game's done, even if we're doing, you know, whiskey or other beverages. So let's go out and acquire some breweries. So where's the growth? Where's the action?
Yeah.
It's America, man. Where are they?
For now.
What's Mitch Steele doing down in Atlanta? That sounds like a good... That's where I throw my dart. What's he doing down there?
He's got two places down there, I think,
and
right?
For those that don't know, Mitch Steele, former Stone brewer for a long time, and then moved to Atlanta and opened up a place.
Yeah. I think he has two places in Atlanta now.
An interesting one. Is it Keith, who's doing the... who launched Blue Moon.
Yeah.
He opened up a marijuana brewery in Colorado.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so.
He was just a keynote at the homebrewers conference.
A marijuana brewery would be a difficult acquisition for a Japanese company, but
right,
if you're looking for growth.
Yeah.
That's one.
Yeah. Well, the South American company that bought Ballast also invested heavily in cannabis up in Canada, too. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a Asahi. I don't know. But yeah, it will be interesting to keep watching, but the number of that size brewery, they're shrinking.
Those sort of mid-tier.
Yeah. Summit, speaking of Minnesota, Summit is still there, right? That's one that could. Bell's is still. They were about to sell and somehow pulled back, I thought, with that one. So that's a big one that could still go.
Coronado, again, still on the table, but I haven't spoken to...
Right.
Chapman in years.
And then the other thing we're going to see is like what happened to Heretic and what happened to Cigar City, where these smaller investment groups buy clusters. So my understanding of the Heretic purchase is that they're looking for others. They want a little cluster of about that size. So that can happen because he was on the big side of a small brewery. Obviously not a massive regional, but pretty good size. So I think we'll see more of that.
I've got a question for you. If you were to acquire a brewery, who would you acquire?
Russian River.
See, that's too easy. Come on. It was something like under the radar, right? You're like, oh, this place, boom.
Yeah. So
my sort of
acquisition would just be I like over-the-counter sales. That's why I opened a bar. So I would open a really small local, or I would purchase a really small local brewery. I don't know. If I had to throw a couple names out there, Original Pattern down in Oakland, mostly because I love the brewer. He's such a great, great brewer, and I like that location. And I want to be in a place where they're going to build the next Oakland A's stadium
that's a good one.
Without starving for the next 5 years while it's being built.
That's a good one.
Stuff like that. What location I really like is Almanac out on Alameda.
Yes.
And they've got a lot of good infrastructure.
Beautiful facility.
Yep.
They're exported to Japan. It's another one.
Oh, right. Yeah. They really went the distribution and export avenue early on as a brewery, even before they had much volume. And I think that was a smart move for them, especially during the pandemic, because that wasn't all just over the counter sales. You know,
I've got two. One of them's funny. Fieldwork. Obvious one because they're awesome. But, go back with Barry and Alex, co-founders. My office in America is actually in the same building. Barry introduced me to them, so thank you, Fieldwork.
Yeah.
But I always joke, like, hey, you know, Barry, I'm meeting with Kirin. Like, how much are you? And he's like, we're not for sale.
Oh, my God.
It's funny, you know, because it's such a great brand. He's like, why would anyone want us? Because, you know, they operate taprooms. But what a great brand.
Well, right. He really capitalizes on the ability to have multiple taprooms. Barry, so Barry is the guy I call when I'm about to make decisions about growth decisions. My GM here and I, Kevin, we call Barry.
He's a smart guy, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And he's a lucky motherfucker, I think.
I hope he's listening. He's such a curmudgeon, a lovable curmudgeon, isn't he?
Yeah. He's always been a strong supporter of us, and he's smart. Uh-huh. The places that he's opened and the way he's done it, yeah. I'd buy Fieldwork, but I'd keep him on.
Yes.
It would be part of the deal.
And Alex too. I mean, you know.
Oh, of course, like, of course.
His recipes are just.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about Modern Times to bring it back to the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, Alex was a part of the launch of Modern Times.
Okay, right? I forgot that. Yeah.
He was the brewer there.
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone's like, well, you can't launch a brewery without a good brewer. He was there.
Yeah.
The second one, I don't really have any sort of personal, I know some of the people there, but I've always been impressed by the quality and the branding of Berryessa.
Oh, yeah.
I really like them as a small brewery.
Great beer. Yeah.
And, you know, like as an acquisition, that's a romantic one. It's not like a big business plan, but it's like one I think, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be really happy if I, you know, on that.
So since we're talking, that's a good question since we're talking acquisitions, but the truthful answer would really have been, I should have opened a brewery 15 years ago. And since I didn't, and I chose the Brewing Network instead,
here we are.
I would never open a brewery now. I would never buy a brewery. I would never open a brewery. I would open another tap room concept, not exactly like the one I already own here at the Hop Grenade. It would have to be different. Mm-hmm. I would do that, but I wouldn't. I would never open a brewery now.
I have a really hard question because you're running a radio station podcast. In addition to this, I'm running a media company, a magazine company. In addition, I get some funds from the import of raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about this all the time. If I could have gone back in my life, would I have opened a magazine company?
It's
such a legacy business and a radio company.
Yeah.
And it's a hard, and I want everyone to think about this. Like you get 15, 20 years into your life, you're like, well, this is just the railroad I'm on, you know? Do you ever feel that way?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay, you get to a certain age and a certain point in your career where you're like, could I start over? Yeah. But do I want to?
It's too late for me.
Fuck that. Yeah. I would have done it the same. I would have still opened the podcast company. At the time, it was an online radio company. I would have done that. But about 5 years in, I should have opened a brewery alongside. I should have put the podcast, the radio station, in a brewery. I should have hired the right brewers, gone and found the investment, and taken the Hop Grenade brand. I think that route. That's the only change I would make. But I'm not completely disappointed with my decisions. I love being a bar owner, even though it kind of sucks a lot of the times. It's just, it's kind of in me. Mm-hmm. I worked so long in the service industry. So I'm not too mad at the choice I made. Of course, during COVID and right now coming out of it, it's so easy to second guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, when we were doing great, I'm just thinking I made all the best decisions in the world. And so now though, you're like, you know, things haven't bounced back quite. Our location is having some trouble. We already closed one location in Colorado. So it's easy to like second guess yourself when,
And I wanted to bring this up because there's probably a lot of people listening now, you know, who in the beer industry or whatever, have faced hard times and running our magazine. There was a point where I called up my mom, my dad, and said, you know, I had a good run. I believed in the magazine industry. I believe in the publishing industry, but it's done. We're not going to make it.
Wow. Yeah.
And I've had the talk with my employees and we're going to shut down. And my mom said, well, really? Are you always say like things are rough? I was like, no, mom, I've actually started like,
the process.
Downloading applications for like law school or something. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I've had the talk with my wife.
Yeah.
And yet we made it to the next month. And it was so shocking when sponsors came back and were like, we got your back.
Yeah.
Well, hey, mom, we got another 3-4 weeks of cash.
We'll see.
And I just want everyone to know, like, we don't talk about it enough in this industry, how hard it's been during the industry. Because everyone's like, you don't want to show how hard it is. And it's been hard. And we survived through, you know, supporting each other and need to keep supporting each other. And, you know, if you fold, if you're one of those people that fold, well, hopefully you did everything that you could. And that's why, that's where I'm proud, where I did everything that I could. And I had the honest conversation with my employees. I don't know how we're going to make it. Mm-hmm. What should we do? What can we do? But we're here. I'm sitting here, you know, and hopefully we can keep going. And the reason I ask you is because it's easy to second guess your decisions in life about what you did. But when you make it through something that's hard, you're like, that was awesome. Like, I did it. And I still love doing this. I'm happy to be here on the radio show and still talk to you about the industry. And, you know, we're talking about Stone, you know, like this much bigger company with a lot more money that had to sell.
Right.
And yet we survived. It's not because we're clever. We had different decisions, but, you know.
It was a bit of luck.
You got to, luck and just be comfortable with what you've done and the decisions you made and the choices you've made. And, you know, if anyone's out there just grinding, like, keep grinding, you know?
Totally.
But think about it, but just keep going because it feels.
We had that moment in the Brewing Network already years ago where I talked to everybody, and I've talked about that on the air. I said, you know, we're going to one more Great American Beer Festival. And if we don't get any sponsors out of that, you know, we were already streaming the awards for them by then. We had a ton of listeners, but the sponsors just weren't responding. And I said, that'll be it. We're going to go. We're going to put on our show. We're going to have the booth. We're going to do what we do and sign autographs. But behind the scenes, if nothing, you know, that's our last shot. And lo and behold, we come home from GABF and the phone starts ringing.
Awesome.
And advertisers are responding and they want to be a part of the network. So I've had that in the Brewing Network once. could happen again, I suppose. And we're maybe there with the Hop Grenade where we're going, we're doing everything we can. Things have got to turn around. Mm-hmm. And my team here is amazing. They come in with new ideas every day. I do think you got to be real and honest about it. And I think the one thing you said that I agree with most is, I know for both of my companies, I do have to feel like I did every single thing that could be done, at least in my power. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there are people that are smarter than me that maybe could have done better. But as long as I've done everything I can in my power, then I'll just call more beer and ask if I can have a job. You know, so, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you to our advertisers, honestly. We wouldn't be around without them. So,
yeah, I know. It's important. And I say the same thing all the time. And our listeners donate as well. Awesome. And those of you who have been donating for a long time, I know I say this all the time, but they have no idea how many times they've saved my ass, our listeners. I have no idea. It's only from a proportion of our listeners that download our show, the number of them that donate is tiny. But the number of times that they've saved this company's ass, they have no idea, is massive. By subscribing, by donating, by going to our events help us out quite a bit. We thank them all the time.
Thank you guys.
You know, and More Beer and having been my sponsor like since before I'd ever did my first show, and they just have always believed in me. They continue to do so today. You know, listener numbers dropped a bit during COVID, and More Beer calls me, and they just want to know how they can help. They're not going, hey, we're pulling out here. They're just like, well, what more can we do? You know. And that stuff, that's super helpful. And it's inspirational. I hope I get to return the favor to some other small company one day.
I think about that all the time, too.
Right? Yeah.
One day we want to have their back.
That's right. That's right. All right, Rye, it has been great talking with you, as always.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have to get you on again sooner than later. It's fascinating what's happening all over the place. So let's stay in touch. Even if we just come on and do some little segments, you know, if you got some info about the next acquisition or
always got bits.
I know you got some surprises up your sleeve with your own companies. Mm-hmm. So keep us informed about all of that too. It'll be fun to keep watching you grow. All right, folks, I'm going to get us out of here. Thanks for tuning in. It's we need you as listeners as well as supporters. Send your feedback to feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com. You can also hit the donate button on our homepage. That'll allow you to donate via PayPal, or you know, just support our sponsors that support us. You can shop on Amazon by clicking the Amazon link on our homepage. There's all sorts of ways to help out, and we appreciate it all the time. I got another show coming up for you this weekend, Liquid Gravity, and I'm hoping Altamont are going to be here on some collaboration beers that they did. Plus, I got some video footage of my party with them this past weekend where we released those collab beers. We'll be releasing them here at the Hop Grenade on Saturday. All right, folks, hang in there. Take care of yourselves and your beer.